This is Conducting Business, WQXR's podcast on the classical music industry. I'm Naomi Lewin. Once upon a time, if musicians wanted to put on a concert or make an album, they had to go talk to people with money, like foundations or angel investors. But now, more and more, they just go online. With crowdfunding websites like Kickstarter.com, you post your project, maybe add a promotional video, and if everything goes well, the internet world chips in to give you the money you need. Earlier this month, a campaign by the punk singer Amanda Palmer raked in $1.2 million, which was a record for Kickstarter. But for every crowdfunding success, there is a project that fails to meet its funding goals. Here to talk about the potential of crowdfunding are three guests. In the studio, Anastasia Sulkis, a producer and reporter at NPR Music, and Michael Royce, executive director of New York Foundation for the Arts, which recently started a crowdfunding site called Artspire. On the line from Nashville is Tracy Silverman, a violinist who recently used Kickstarter.com to raise money for a recording project. So Tracy, why did you turn to Kickstarter to finance your latest recording?
Well, I think the two reasons were speed, you know, not having to wait a year or sometimes 2 years for a grant proposal to be approved, and also the way it helps at the same time to activate a fan base and develop buyers for the product that we're raising, you know, money for.
Did you consider going a more traditional route with your financing?
Well, I did. And, you know, I had a timeline. I wanted to get this recording done this summer, have it out in the fall, and I was planning this just this last winter. I had, you know, the possibility of writing grant proposals, meeting certain deadlines, and, you know, the money wouldn't come around until the summer or the fall, if it happened at all. Then the record would, you know, be on hold until then. So it was really a way to expedite it, to get it done. Also, it was a way for me to just control the project better.
So who wound up giving you money?
Well, my parents gave me some, which was nice, but most of it came from fans, from people who have known my work and my music over the years. It was a wonderful feeling to know that there were people out there who, just by my putting it out there into the world and saying, hey, I want to do this recording. I think it's a really cool piece of music that I wrote, if I must say so, and a really cool artist that I want to work with, the Calder Quartet, a string quartet out of Los Angeles, and I'd like to do this, and then to find out that there are people who were just, it seemed, looking for an opportunity to support what I do, and who said, great, here's $3,000, you know, we'd love to help your project, or some people who said, great, here's $10. You know, we're in, and everything in between.
That's very cool. Anastasia, yeah. A lot of rock bands and independent filmmakers and even gadget inventors have turned to crowdfunding. How viable has it actually been for classical music?
Well, I think it's important to point out, Kickstarter has become this sort of umbrella for, I think they call it, creative projects in the widest possible sphere. But classical musicians, especially those who have been successful entrepreneurs in other realms, seem to be doing really well. A couple months ago, I wrote a piece for NPR about this, and one of my case studies, as it were, was Brooklyn Rider. And they'd set out to spend, I think it was $30,000 to record their most recent recording and raised over 50. And you have to say that these guys are incredibly astute at networking and in terms of building social media for themselves. I think Kickstarter becomes one piece of a larger puzzle, and it can't be self-contained. I think that a mistake that people are making is throwing a project up, and it could be a very worthy project, but they're not leveraging their network. They're not asking people they know, their fans. They're just sort of hoping that somebody will see a project. And I think people are getting much smarter about it, but it's also a good way for musicians, I think, working in genres outside of the huge mainstream, people who are not Amanda Palmer, to find like-minded enthusiasts and find people who would say, I would love to encourage writings of new wind quintets, or I would love to encourage a new choral piece, or whatever it is, that people are able to work well beyond their most local networks and really find a community of like-minded people.
Michael, over half of the Kickstarter projects that are out there, 56% in fact, fail to meet their funding goals. How does that compare to other conventional fundraising campaigns?
Well, I think it's hard for any classical musician or any artist to raise money, period. And so there is a failure rate, no matter what your project is, no matter what your experience is, no matter what your network is, there is a failure rate. But the beauty of microphilanthropy or crowdfunding is that the artist is in control of raising that money and how they promote what the project is and how they promote themselves and what their creative process is. They can actually communicate online. They can show you through videos or streamlining. And so at ArtSpire, you actually have to apply to be put on the site. So it's a competitive process. And we convene an expert panel to look at their budget to make sure it's realistic, to look at their experience to make sure that they've done it before. And if they haven't, we have a professional staff to actually help them. For us, the failure rate tends to stay low because the projects that are put online to solicit your dollars are those projects that a bunch of people have said, yes, this particular person or this artist has the wherewithal, has the experience, has the sophistication, has the past success, or has the brilliant idea that will solicit donations. And hopefully the artist has been using social media before he or she actually launches their project and solicits funds, so that all those people, whether they're on Twitter or on Facebook or some other social media site, comes on to see what you're up to, right? And they want to encourage you and they become part of you. And the great thing about these websites is that there is ownership not just from the artist, but from the donors. The donors are part of the creative process. They help you build that project and realize that dream.
So Tracy, tell us, how did it actually work for you? How did you inspire people to support your project? And how did you engage your social network?
I did activate my fan base as much as possible through social media. In fact, I hired a social media person to help me organize it and to make sure that I was, you know, doing it properly. As you know, I am a musician and not a social media expert. So, you know, I really tweaked my Facebook and Twitter stuff, and you know, there's a whole art to it. As most people are aware now, you don't want to ask for too much money. You want to bring interesting other projects to people's attention and things like that. So, and all of that, I think, was very, very helpful. And
Tracy,
it was helpful to generate that.
This is Michael. If I could ask you, because I'm curious about your process with the raising money, if you were able to offer your donors a tax deduction with their contribution, would that have been a helpful tool or did it not matter?
I bet it would. And in fact, to be honest with you, I was actually under the impression that Kickstarter contributions were tax deductible. Is that not the case?
It is not the case. There are many crowdfunding websites out there that are for profits. Kickstarter is one of those. When you go through a not-for-profit, and each artist has to decide for him or herself what works best for them, but you do have the added enhanced value of giving a tax deduction to your individual donors. And also, there are many foundations, corporations that are precluded to giving money to individual artists, but they can give it to a not-for-profit. So if you are, for example, on the ArtSpire site, you can secure those very large grants, $100,000, $200,000, which allows the foundation, the corporations, to give the money to ArtSpire, and then we give it to you.
How important do you think that is in getting contributions? Do you think an artist could get more contributions?
I think it depends on the project. For some artists, it doesn't matter. They just need to raise a quick $5,000, and they need to do it in 30 days, and that's what they need to do. So something like Kickstarter is perfect for them. For other artists, you know, if it's presenting a new play, or it's performing a new symphony, or it's a dance project, these costs can be quite significant, and you also want to attract the attention of the national foundations or the corporations that might in fact sponsor your next project. So then it becomes very important to them. It all depends on where you want to go with the project. If it's just a one-time thing and you only need $20,000, it's not important at all. If you want to start establishing relationships with the major funders out there, including the very wealthy individual, it may become quite significant.
One of the things that I think is very interesting and sort of came to mind when you were just speaking, Michael, is something that came up in our comments after I wrote my piece. People are asking, is there a real difference in works that are more evanescent, like a live performance, versus those that are recorded or have some sort of life beyond a certain run of performances? That is there a real difference in funding and enthusiasm about funding, that if there's something tactile or some recorded thing?
And what was the verdict?
I don't have an answer. Oh. I'm just curious.
Well, you know, I can say I know that there are crowdfunding websites where in return for a donation you receive something, and that may be a copy of the recording, let us say. On our site, we don't require that you give the donor anything, and the donor doesn't expect anything other than to be part of the project. So the chance to come and actually hear the music makes a huge difference.
Now, Tracy, I want to ask you about different incentive levels, because you offer different incentive levels of gifts and funding credits.
Right.
Do you think those... I come from the world of, you know, fundraising for a nonprofit where we also have incentive levels. Do you think that made a difference for your project?
Well, I'm sure it did. I didn't have any tote bags or mugs,
You're missing out.
Right.
But you did have a copy of the recording once it's done.
Right. A copy of the recording, autograph, posters, things like that. On other levels, I had Skype violin lessons that I offered. I think that was $100 or $150, something like that. So there were different levels. And there were a number of people who donated $50 and said, we don't need any gift or anything. Yeah.
I noticed you had note takers on the level that included two nights in a hotel in Los Angeles to watch the recording session. Now, it seems like that would have taken a pretty big bite out of the money you raised.
Yeah.
It's not like giving a house concert, which is giving your own talent. And
right. Well, luckily nobody took me up on it.
Anastasia, classical music audiences are by and large older, so... Are they going to be as... No.
I
mean, the people with money,
yes,
by and large, are older.
I will go with you on that.
Are those people with money going to be as reachable through an internet startup?
Well, that's an interesting thing. And I think that goes back to how smart people are in leveraging it. I think that classical musicians and other kind of so-called niche musicians have to be cognizant of the fact that their audiences and their supporters aren't necessarily going to be trolling through Kickstarter on a weekly basis looking for interesting new projects. If they instead are saying to a live audience, hey, if you enjoy the show, please come check us out on whichever of these funding sites, and here's our project, and then by happenstance they come across this whole universe of similarly minded projects, terrific. But I think that classical musicians would have to be a little smart about introducing this idea to their audiences. I mean, I think that by and large, there are certain things that we know now that we didn't know a few years ago or weren't true a few years ago. I believe that this is still true. The largest growing segment of Facebook users are people over the age of, I think, 60. So really, as social media matures, there's an evolution in audiences too. Now, somebody's grandfather on Facebook isn't necessarily going to be going over to ArtSpy or to Kickstarter. But if you can find avenues to channel your fans and enthusiasts towards these sites, I don't see why not. I mean, I think we at this point are living in a time that we have to assume that most people have some degree of technical fluency.
And I just want to add to that, because I think that you're right. There is a marketing that's happening, or an education that's happening, or an awareness for people of all ages. I know that for our site, because we're so arts-centered, and that's all that we are, is arts-centers, where there are other sites that are much broader than that, as you said, Anastasia, in the creative process, what they call it. We have people who have the means, who actually come on our site and go through all the projects and see what it is they're interested in, and then they make a donation because these websites or this technology is now available. And they like sitting in their home and saying to themselves, who can I help today? They actually enjoy it.
Tracy, I think you had something you wanted to add about.
Yes, I was going to mention that I actually timed my my Kickstarter campaign to coincide with a five-week tour that I was doing, playing 34 cities. And so I did, you know, realize that getting in front of people performing is, you know, is the best way to reach people, and would have cards and things on the merchandise table after the concert that I would sign. And so I was promoting it, you know, live as well as online.
In other words, exactly what Anastasia just said.
Yep. And, of course, you know, as performers know, you know, because we sell CDs after concerts, there's a certain impulse buying when people are in the moment and they're enjoying a concert, that it's a great way to reach your fan base.
Anastasia and Michael, you probably have your fingers more on statistics about this, but any statistics on whether this is, however, new money? I mean, because you're talking
whether
about
it's new,
people
I don't
who are
know.
Trolling through your
I
site looking
no
for...
I have no idea whether okay. it's new, but I would assume that it does attract new donors because they now have the ability, right, to just sit in their living room in their pajamas and send money off.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Kickstarter got into a little bit of a fracas earlier this year because one of the founders, who I should say, Yancy Strickler, whom I used to work with as a freelancer at eMusic, just as a point of disclaimer, who became one of the founders of Kickstarter, said that Kickstarter was now dispersing more money in the arts than the NEA. And he said, well, we're dispersing about $150 million.
The National Endowment for the Arts.
The National Endowment for the Arts. We're going to be dispersing $150 million in 2012, and the NEA is only dispersing $146 million. Now, that became an incredibly contentious statement on all kinds of levels. First of all, creativity, what does that, as we said at the beginning, does that mean a taco truck? Does it mean an iPod charger? Like, what does that mean? Second of all, you know, the NEA and grant-making organizations have certain missions, you know, certain geographical distribution they want to reach, underserved communities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in ways that Kickstarter, it's just not part of their mission and part of their goal. But it's a very interesting point of comparison. You have, I can only imagine, some number, undefined number, but some number of people who have never felt compelled to give to artists. They might buy albums, they might buy merchandise, and we all know that merchandise is much more important now than it used to be. But to give money saying, I want to hear you record X, here's $10. That's a direct level of interaction that I think is really new.
Tracy, how did you go about setting your fundraising goal? Because you have to pick one that's realistic if you're going to get funded by Kickstarter.
It's a good question. Well, I estimated the budget of the recording, and that was set at about $15,000, which involved largely the artist fees to the quartet, the recording, studio engineer, blah, 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 and the pressing of CDs. But I actually only asked for 12 because I just felt that it was going to be hard to reach a goal of 15. So we just sort of downsized it, and, you know, I think that was the right thing to do because we didn't get much beyond 12, and it's better to have 12 than nothing, because if you don't reach your goal, none of it goes through.
Was it like pulling teeth, or did you have a fairly easy time making the goal?
You know, it wasn't super easy.
Did you have to send out repeat reminders and all that kind of thing?
We did send out, you know, there was definitely a campaign where we decided, you know, we were going to send out an email blast every 2 weeks, and then on the last 3 weeks, we were going to send them weekly. And, you know, I created videos with samples, with me playing, performing samples of the music, talking about the music, all of these things that are engaging of your audience base anyway.
Would you use something like this again?
I'm sure I would, although I think you have to be careful that you're not, you know, having a Kickstarter campaign every other month asking for money. It's the kind of thing I think you have to do judiciously.
The risk being the artist who cried Kickstarter.
Exactly, exactly. But I tell you what, it did teach me a few things.
Such as?
Such as how to help to engage my audience. What kinds of things you do to get their attention in a positive way.
Were there any pitfalls you encountered or any cautionary words you might have for anybody who's thinking of doing this?
I think a good thing to go into it with is to say, okay, here, you know, you define your project and what it is you're asking for, and think ahead of time, how am I going to I hate to use this word, but in a sense, sell this to average fans, to the people out there who I think might be interested. What is it about the project? How am I going to engage them? Should I play it for them? Should I talk about it? Obviously, showing is better than talking whenever you can. Things like that, just sort of interesting behind-the-scenes views of what I do. Stuff like that.
I was going to actually jump in, Tracy, if you don't mind, and say one of the things when I wrote my article, I asked the same question. And one of the most interesting things in the responses we got are how open artists were to saying, gosh, what I know now, having done Kickstarter or what have you once or twice, you know, people were very forthcoming with specific things. They said, you know, I really wish I had lined up some sort of larger seed money donors to either kick off the campaign and let them know it was happening so that it could have a nice big start, or conversely, have a couple of big donors lined up and ready to contribute the last couple of days. I thought that was a very interesting insight. And
it's great if you can.
Of course, that's the caveat. If you can, if you have that sort of support already, which is sort of an interesting thing, an irony that you have to have some support already to do this effectively.
Right.
And another thing that comes to mind in what you were just saying in terms of you don't want to be, you know, the artist who cried Kickstarter is how much this to me correlates with other lessons from especially social media and networking. I've done over the years a lot of sort of 101s for artists on how to promote themselves on social media. And one thing I've always said is don't make everything broadcast, broadcast, broadcast. It's about interaction. Don't just shoot out messages about we have X show on Y date and come.
Right.
You know, it's about engagement and some amount of back and forthing, you know, and which makes, I think, a richer experience both for the creator and for the audience. But it feels like something very similar is at play here too. You don't want to just be saying, and it's March and I need this money, in September I need that money.
Yeah, I want to add to that if I can, because you said something really important, which is it's the engagement part. Tracy, when you said, you know, you don't want to use this word pitch or sell, I totally agree with you, because I don't believe that's what an artist should be doing. I think what an artist should be doing is connecting him or herself to their audience, and the audience is connecting back, and that is how the chains, you know, loosen up. That is when the money comes. If your audience feels that they are, again, engaged with you, helping you create the project, and also that something inside of them has been tapped, they may not be a composer themselves, but maybe they have dreams, maybe they have unmet, unrealized visions, maybe music heals them in a way that they just can't explain. If you can tap into that, that is, if you will, your pitch or your sell, and they will give you money because they want to be part of it. So it's not pitching, it's connecting.
It's exactly right. And, you know, it kind of goes back to something I discovered about teaching, is that the most important thing as a teacher is enthusiasm. And by just turning people on to cool stuff that's out there in the arts, it gets them kind of engaged in the general world of the arts, which a lot of people, if that's not their business, it helps to have somebody going, hey, look at this. Hey, listen to this. This is really cool, because they're busy with their own lives. And, you know, it really takes somebody to do that, to just yank you by the arm and go, you got to check this guy out, and for it to not be yourself, you know.
So, Michael, for every Tracy Silverman or Kronos Quartet or Vasily Primakov who has used crowdfunding like this, there's also some weird guy pitching his terrible garage band or terrible trio. Do you think we're going to see more big-name artists and organizations using this kind of funding, or is it going to stay more of a kind of grassroots thing?
I think you'll see bigger names. I think even the superstars want to connect to their audiences, and they want to know that their audiences, you know, it's like the Obama campaign, right? He connected to individuals all around the country who wanted to give $5, $10, $15 because he touched something in them, and they're going to use that same campaign style again. Right, so I think superstars or big names will go after it as well. They like knowing that they're supported individually. It's a good feeling.
That's a great way to leave it. Thank you all very much for a very interesting conversation.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. I loved it.
Yeah, great to meet you guys.
This has been Conducting Business, a podcast on the classical music industry from WQXR.org. I've been speaking with Anastasia Sulkis of NPR Music, Michael Royce of the New York Foundation for the Arts, and violinist Tracy Silverman. Brian Weiss is our producer, and Bill O'Neill is our engineer. You can subscribe to the Conducting Business podcast on iTunes. I'm Naomi Lewin. Thanks so much for listening.